to help create a process to slowly allow these kids to access the amazing, most, from what I understand, the most incredible thing that scientists know exists in the universe, which is our brains. It's amazing.
Well, the gift of a brain is the gift of life.
Today, I sat down with Susan Calley, who serves as the executive director of the Talitha Kum Institute. Talitha Kum is a therapeutic brain development center for children from the ages of birth to five, located in the Kate Ross neighborhood of Waco, Texas. I've known Susan for close to a decade. During that time, I've watched her sacrificially devote herself to improving the lives of Waco's children. We talk about the heart-wrenching story that led to Talitha Kum's founding, and what decades of experience and research have shown as it relates to understanding and healing the effects of trauma born from the intense stress of deep poverty. Put simply, Talitha Kum's gift to the children and community it serves is a healthy, functioning brain. Not a brain full of knowledge, facts, wisdom, or insight yet, but one that will be ready to learn and retain all of those things. I want to give a very brief background on this podcast. I have a tendency to read the news and extrapolate worst-case scenarios. It often seems these days that no extrapolation is needed. The challenges our world faces are never further away than the phone in my pocket. And yet, on an almost daily basis, in my small corner of a small city, I have interactions that fill me with hope and joy. That may be hearing the laughter of my children, learning some small thing that makes me fall deeper in love with my wife, watching a friend stepping out and trying something new, or stories of kindness being showered on people in our community. If for nothing other than my benefit, I'd like to lean into those stories. I thought conversations with the women and men who have devoted themselves in service of others would be a good place to start. I hope today's conversation will be the first of many, and that Susan's words leave you as moved as they did me. Well, Susan, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. I'm really excited about this. I've been excited about this for weeks. Would you mind just giving us an overview of the Talitha Kum Institute? What does it do?
Sure. Talitha Kum is a mental health therapeutic nursery, which sounds like a big mouthful, but I say that because we are not a child care center. And if someone comes to visit and looks at us, they could say, oh, this looks like a Montessori classroom. Oh, this looks like any other high quality child care center. And we're careful to say it is a mental health brain development center for children birth to five. And they're children who come from pretty much extreme poverty, and we'll talk, I'm sure, later about what that does to a child's brain. But we're there to do brain development, birth to five, and we have a family partner program that helps parents set their own goals, meet their own goals, so that we reduce the stress in their household. We also have a mentoring program that is kindergarten to college. My mentee graduated in December. I was so excited. She graduated from Stephen F. Austin. And that's a really vital program that costs us nothing to run. So the three legs of the stool were always that we would have a parent program, a nurture center program, and then we also want to have those children with us as much as possible. And so they stay until 5:30 in the afternoon. And if their parent works and wants us to keep the child, and I've even encouraged parents to go home and take a nap. Why don't you just go home and take a nap? Why don't you go to the grocery store and be less stressed about all of those things? So those are the things we do all day.
How many kids would you say that you have in the nurture center right now?
We can only have 30 and be therapeutic. So we have 5 classrooms, 6 children in each classroom. And all the way through pre-K, we're a ratio of 1 teacher to 3 children, 6 in a class. And so that's the most we can have right this minute.
So tell me a little bit about Susan Calley before you became executive director of Talitha Coombe. Are you native to Texas and Waco?
No, but I did come to Baylor, and like many do now, I stayed. Married a Baylor student who was in law school, and when he got out of law school, he said, well, you have a great job here, why don't we stay here? But I'm from New Orleans. He was from a small town in South Texas. And we married up, and Waco was the perfect size home for us. It was between big city and small town. So my whole life was as a writer, and I owned a marketing firm for many years. And I never intended to be the executive director of Talitha Coombe. I was one of its founders, and it was always my calling and close to my heart. But I didn't think I ever needed to be the executive director, so I was getting towards retirement from the marketing firm, and I thought, oh, I'll just relax now. And God had a different plan, and I followed that plan.
One thing I was thinking about, I have to be honest, in that the first time that I ever heard the name Talitha Coombe, I thought, what in the world kind of name is that? So can you explain to me what that means and where it came from?
Well, yes, I can. And don't feel bad. I've had pastors of churches come and ask me if Miss Coombe is available to speak to them. And I very graciously say, you know, your eye just skips over this. In the book of Mark, chapter 5, there's a story about Jesus and Jairus, who came running to say his daughter was dying, and he needed Jesus to come help. Jesus was not in any big hurry and stopped to heal someone else. And by the time he got there, the people outside said, oh, you're too late. It's okay. You don't need to go in. And Jesus said, well, I think I will. And they laughed at him. And he went in with the parents and 2 of his disciples. And he stood over this child. She was 12 years old. And he said, Talitha Coombe, my child, rise up. And she did. And then he said some of the best words in the scripture, get her something to eat. And I've always thought, wow, that was terrific. I mean, if you've been dead, you need your sugar. So he said that, she rose up. And so our thought when we named it Talitha Coombe was we wanted something tied to scripture. We are a Christian faith-based ministry. We wanted something tied to scripture, but we also were hopeful that all of the children we serve would rise up, because there is a certain kind of death happening to children in America who live in extreme poverty. And partially it's a death of their brain power, and we didn't want to lose that. So the whole idea of a child rising up was influential to us. And at the time, I thought it was a terrible name. I thought nobody will be able to spell it, so will they be able to Google it? Will they ever find it? And right at that time, this was 2002, 2003 when we opened, and it was soon after 9/11, and I thought it might sound so foreign that people didn't have any affinity for it. But it has always served us well. People always ask, and I always forget to tell them, what does it mean? And so I do frequently have people ask if Miss Coombe is there, and we set that right pretty quickly.
What led to the founding of Talitha Coombe?
That is a very long story I'm going to make really, really short, as short as I can. We were 3 women in 1989 who wanted to be church together, and we were modeling ourselves after Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C., and we went to the Kate Ross Public Housing neighborhood to learn from and love the poor. We had no agenda. We bought a little house across the street from Kate Ross and moved in there and started the ministry of hanging out, we called it. And we hung out in the neighborhood for 8 years, having only Sunday night worship and the hanging out during the daytime, waving at the neighbors, sitting on the front porch. They really thought we were the oddest bird ever in the neighborhood. We didn't look quite right, and they thought we were witches in the beginning. We got past the witch stage, and we knew we were welcomed in the neighborhood when the neighbors would start bringing back things that were stolen from this little house. Oh, I know who took that. I'll go get it. They go get your jam box, whatever, and bring it back. And it was, we became neighbors. But during that time, we watched children come to our door and bring their backpack in, and they were mesmerized that Marcia, our pastor, would pull out everything in the backpack and exclaim over each item and put things on the refrigerator. And then the next day they'd bring their friends who had their backpacks wide open waiting for Marcia to get excited about what they'd done at school. So we began to watch them, but 8 years in, we started the Gospel Cafe ministry at the corner of 10th and Cleveland. That's where we really saw families together and where we realized that they were under so much stress that pretty much every social determinant of health was lacking for these folks, and that they were in severe stress, the kind that becomes toxic, and so for the whole family. And so we decided to start a youth group, and we did, and there were many, many 13 to 18-year-olds who loved our youth group, but they were getting pregnant early, they were literally dying young, and before long, we couldn't tolerate the dissonance between loving them and losing them. One year, we buried three teenagers, and we saw one from the Kate Ross area graduate from high school. That was kind of the end of the line for us. We said, oh, this is, God did not call us here to bury teenagers. So we went down to the local public school thinking we were going to start a charter school. We thought, well, these kids need maybe a different, smaller, different kind of school. We went to Sol Ross Elementary and we asked the question, what is your number one problem with an entering kindergartner? And honestly, JT, we thought we knew the answer. They would say they haven't been read to, they don't know their letters, they don't know their numbers. Oh, no. This educator didn't skip a beat. She looked right into our eyes and she said, their mental health is already shot and they can't learn. That was at least 10 years before neuroscience could show you why their mental health was shot. If she hadn't used kind of those exact words, their mental health is already shot and they can't learn, at five, I'm not sure who we would be today. We walked out and sat on the curb, and I looked at these gals with me. We were four women by that time, one educator, well, two educators actually, an occupational therapist, and me, a writer who owned a marketing firm. I didn't know anything. I said, well, all I hear is five is too late. Five is too late. If we start a school, that's too late. What are we going to do with that information? And Carol Salverson, our occupational therapist then and today, said, we're going to go see Dr. Keith Warren. He's a child psychologist, was doing play therapy and various kinds of therapy. We went to see Keith, and he was ready. He was ready. He said, I've waited and waited to say this to the right people. Please start a mental health therapeutic nursery and start at birth. Don't you let anyone tell you to start at two. Start at birth, because your best window is conception to two for brain development. And I was excited because he was so sure of himself. And I said, oh, wonderful, Keith, where can we visit one in Texas? And he said, well, you can't. There aren't any in Texas, but look them up online. They're in the Northeast. And we did, and that was a little daunting because in the Northeast, they were located inside major universities who were doing research, major medical centers doing research, and so they gave all their resources to this. And we were four women without a dime. And we thought, well, if this is the best thing to do, and God has called us to do it, the gifts and the graces will follow. And they always have. For 21 years, we've never missed a payroll. We've come close, but never missed a payroll. And our neighbors, our community, has just been so good to us. So that is as quickly as I can give you our history.
And what age do you take in kids?
8 weeks. As early as 8 weeks. And that's a fascinating thing because some people will say, why does an infant need a mental health therapeutic nursery? And then we explain things, but along the way, anecdotes are good. We've had more than one infant come to us so shut down they didn't wake up to eat, did not make a sound all day, would stay curled up in a ball. And what we knew from the neuroscience that we follow carefully is that an infant can be so shut down that they're what is called frozen. There's fight, flight, and freeze. There are other words, but freeze means this child has just, you know, somewhere innately inside, this is not a safe world for them. They're not coming out. So one of ours, who was 9 weeks old, his mother thought he was blind. And we said, why do you think he's blind? And he had a very dull stare over her shoulder. He was not giving her any eye contact. And we'd worked with her before with five of her children. She knew her babies. This one was different. And so we brought him in, and he, sure enough, for 3 days, didn't make a sound, didn't wake up. He was so shut down. And so his teacher came to Donna and said, what do we do? And she said, well, you act as if. Let's pick him up and say, Johnny, you're so wet. You must be uncomfortable. Johnny, you're so hungry. Let's eat. And teacher did that for 3 months with no change. And then one day, his mother was walking down the hall, bringing him to that room, and he heard his teacher's voice. It was a man. He heard his teacher's voice and broke into little giggles. And it was another 3 weeks before he gave his teacher eye contact. It took that long for the child to awaken to the belief that he was safe. If a child really knows they're safe, they'll come out. They won't hide anymore because the world is a delicious place. They want to participate in it if they can. And so the great joy we have then is watching that child, and we did for the next 4 years, come fully into life, fully ready to participate and learn and experience things. And, you know, people say, well, what if you hadn't been there? Oh, well, if we hadn't been there, Johnny does grow bigger. He does go to public school at the age of 4. And he's so shut down, he doesn't learn. And so when she said their mental health is already shot, there's a long neuroscience, you know, get in the weeds kind of explanation about that. But he couldn't stay in his prefrontal cortex. Everything you learn at a high level in your brain. The foundation of that has to be there. And it's the brainstem and the limbic system sloshing around with all your emotional feelings. There has to be a way to be both calm and alert at the same time. And it doesn't sound like much. Calm and alert is high level. It keeps you in your prefrontal cortex, and that's where you learn, that's where you process language. And so if you're falling into your brainstem all day because you're terrified, you're not available to learn anything. And that educator just knew it. She knew their mental health was already shot, and they weren't learning.
So hearing that, it makes me wonder, what is the typical situation of a Talitha Kum child? Where might they live? What might their home life look like? Where is mom? Where is dad?
I really want to say first that because these families have lived in multi-generation poverty, what HUD would call, Housing and Urban Development would call most of their income situations extremely low, I want to say we don't ever blame parents or families for what's happening with their children. They are doing the very best they can in highly stressful situations. The real enemy, JT, is poverty. Poverty is such an enemy to families because it creates so much stress. It goes so high over mom and dad's head, they can barely function. And yet, they may hold two or three jobs. And when they come to pick up their children or even to drop them off in the morning, there is so much stress. It almost emanates out of their bodies. You feel it being near them. We don't blame them for anything. And people say, well, what do you make your parents do? We say, well, we ask them to please be there by 8:30 in the morning, pick them up by 3:30 or 5:30 if they're working or just want some time to themselves. We ask them. We don't make You can't make a person do anything. You may think you can, but you cannot. And so we ask them to do that and give them the freedom to try just to live in this very difficult situation that they find themselves in. We have parents, if a tire blows, it is so hard for us to understand what can happen to a family if one tire blows. It happened on our curb one day, and I saw a mother go into a full meltdown. She was in her brainstem. She was losing her mind, screaming and crying as if she were about to die. And when I could get her calm enough to tell me, what she was saying was, if I can't drive, I can't buy a tire. I can't buy a used tire. I don't even know how to change a tire. But if I lose transportation, I can't get to work. I can't bring the children here. But if I don't get to work, it could be 2 or 3 weeks before I'm homeless. And she was a person who had been homeless before. She had been homeless more than once. She knew what was about to happen to her. And when I assured her we were not going to let that happen, she began to relax and her breathing changed. And before she went home, we had a tire on her car and she could breathe again. But that's how close to the edge folks live who are in extreme poverty, or even at the low end of very low. And so we do everything we can, which is why the Family Partner Program is so essential for us, everything we can to help mom and dad reduce the toxic stress that's eating away at their bandwidth to be with their children. You think about it, almost every parent knows. There have been times when we just were so stressed out about something, even if it was in the moment, we were just asking our children to be quiet or to go play in the other room. There's nowhere to go for kids who are in a tiny apartment. There isn't going. And so mom doesn't have much bandwidth to deal with their issues or to be with them in a very positive, safe way where kids feel secure. And when you ask, you know, what is their life like, it's the stress in the home that changes everything for them. And so, as I said, we don't blame parents. We support parents. We love them. We give them everything we can of emotional support. And they respond to that. They respond very well to that.
I still remember the first time that I took a tour of Talitha Koum. I remember you explaining to me, like you're saying now, the effects that intergenerational significant poverty has on kids. And just by way of example, I remember you talking about, all right, JT, your three boys, I have no doubt, have a regular nighttime routine, go to bed at whatever it is, o'clock, they have a bed. They wake up roughly the same time, and just gave as an example going to bed at 1:30 in the morning, maybe because whatever the reason is. And I wholeheartedly agree with you about the premise of not blaming mom or dad. I completely understand what you mean by that, and 0% do I want to do that. I think our charge is to come alongside, to try to support, to learn from. So I'm not trying to blame mom or dad. But at the same time, if Johnny, in your earlier example, does go to bed one night at 10, one night at 3, I can only imagine that being an example of a thing that would cause significant ramifications to their brain development.
Yes. And your brain, JT, and mine, we were lucky. The accident of birth is the greatest predictor of how things work out for you. But you were born into a family, and they weren't thinking neurobiology. They were doing what they knew to do, which was to give you sequential experiences. Your brain built from the brainstem up on sequential experiences, and you had them every day. You did know where you were going to eat. You probably had a place at a dining room table that was your place. Nobody sat there but you, and you knew it was your place. So you grew up with all the structures in place that helped your brain best develop and grow from the bottom to the top. That's the neurosequential model that we follow. Neurosequentially, your brain's going to start in the brainstem, and by the time you can control your own temperature in the brainstem, you're moving along, move through your limbic system. You get to all this learning space at the very last of brain development. It's the reason we talk to infants, but we don't expect them to learn from what we say. So we give them a lot of serve in return. Oh, I see you. You are important to me. I see you. I see what you just did. Now I'm going to do it with you. I'm going to do it the same way you did it. And then you're going to do it again, and we're going to pass the ball back and forth. That's the earliest beginnings of brain development. But yes, you had that security that you knew what was coming. The reason we have picture schedules on our walls, and I always point this out to visitors and tour guests, those picture schedules show this is what we're doing now. We move the butterfly, and the butterfly moves along the wall, and this is what we're doing next, and we're going to have a small group, and it goes through all of that, and the kids are so They're so related to that after a while that if we skip a step, if we skip small group, someone's going to say, you didn't do small group, because it makes them feel safe. They want to know what's coming next, and they don't want you to vary that, because this is the safe place where the people are safe. They speak to you kindly always, and the security of that is what makes brain development really possible.
I want to get into the premise of brain development. So I see able to self-regulate and ready to learn by age 5 all over your materials. So would you say that sort of two-pronged premise is Talitha Kum's main goal, or you know, one of the core goals? And I don't know, you know, before I first learned about TK, I don't think I even knew really what self-regulation was. Now, as a parent of 3 boys, I see it every single day, every minute of every day. But you know, when you say able to self-regulate and ready to learn, what do you mean by that?
If a child goes to public school and can self-regulate, that means they can listen to the teacher, they can follow instructions, they can calm down when they get upset. If they can do those things, they are ready to learn because they can stay in their prefrontal cortex. They're both calm and alert at the same time. And while it sounds easy, I always tell college students who come to visit, when was the last time you were in class and you felt very calm, but you were thinking about something else and you heard the teacher say the word test, and you came alive and you turned to the person next to you and you said, test? What test? What were we talking about? What is? Because you were thinking about something else, so you weren't alert. But children who can't self-regulate are always ready for the next bad thing that's going to happen, and they're either in full fight mode and their stress response system goes off without any, it looks like no provocation at all, or they're so shut down they keep their head down. Either way, they're not learning because they're not calm and alert at the same time. That's what self-regulation brings to a child. And it is the brain. The brain has to be developed for self-regulation. One of the things we learned early on is that in your infancy, you don't really even get to 6 months old before your stress response system is hardwired in your brain. It's still malleable. But those first 6 months of life, what if you cry and somebody comes one time, but the next time you cry and cry and cry and cry and shriek and get louder and louder, but no one comes? Or your 4-year-old sister comes and she wants you to have the bottle in her hand, but she doesn't know how to give it to you. And so you don't get fed, or you can't get any satisfaction for the needs your whole body is screaming to get. By 6 months old, if that stress response system is hardwired, there's not the same response that you would get from a child whose mother or father came every time they cried, picked them up, soothed them, calmed them, gave them what they needed. That child ends up feeling that the world is a safe and secure place to be. This is a good place. People are going to treat me well. And so they go to public school. They expect things are going to go well for them. They're calm. They're alert. A child who feels that the world is not a safe place and that there have been people in their environment or even in their neighborhood who frighten them, cause them to feel unsafe, they'll end up in school feeling that this is a threatening place. And if a child just bumps into them sideways, oh, the fist goes in this child's belly or face, and our child didn't even know it was about to happen. Had no idea, because the stress response system is wired so tightly that almost anything will set it off. So if it sets it off and he puts his fist over here in somebody's face, what generally happens is the teacher, and again, it's like parents, we don't blame schools. I understand what they're up against. The teacher or some adult is saying, generally standing over the child, which is a little threatening, saying, why did you do that? Why? And the child doesn't know why, can't answer, and you begin to look obstinate, you begin to look like you have that oppositional defiant personality disorder. It looks that way, but the child has no answer. The other thing to remember is the child is not in their prefrontal cortex where they process language. So what they hear from the adults all around them is wah, wah, wah. It's like Charlie Brown. Wah, 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 wah. Don't even know what you're saying to me because I'm lost in my brainstem or my limbic system. I can't answer that question. So having a child who can self-regulate and is not apt to put their fist in somebody's face or belly is all important for a child not experiencing the school-to-prison pipeline, which is a devastating trajectory to go to public school and end up in prison. But we have really, literally witnessed it with kids we knew.
Okay, so what is then, would you say, is the secret sauce to take kids from being unable to self-regulate to being able to self-regulate?
Oh, it's such a good question. We started with the high scope cognitive curriculum because the Perry Preschool Project was by then 30, 40 years longitudinal study saying, this is the thing, this is the secret sauce, you want to use high scope. And so we started there, and it's great. We're still using it. I wouldn't change that for anything in the world. But we realized about 7 or 8 years in, Carol Salveson, pediatric OT, who's was one of our founders, said, well, not enough sensory motor, not enough to develop the brain well. And high scope has sensory motor components as part of the regular curriculum. She said, it's not going to be enough for our kids. So we then started looking, long story short, started looking for who is the guru we need to be following around. And our clinical director of psychology, Dr. Helen Benedict, said, you know, I think we ought to take a look at this Bruce Perry guy. He's a neuroscientist. He's a medical doctor of pediatric psychiatry. And he had written a book called The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. And it's a hard read, but it's compelling, and every chapter shows how he ended up developing what's called a neurosequential model. Neurosequential meaning, how does the brain develop? Why does it develop that way? And if we want to do a great intervention, how do we do it? Do we talk to the child? Do we do talk therapy with little kids who are highly dysregulated? Well, he learned, no, you don't. And you do it much differently. So we follow Dr. Bruce Perry like little puppies running around after him. Whatever he says, we follow. And so we are certified in the neurosequential model of therapeutics and the neurosequential model in education. And Dr. Perry's very serious about certification. He won't let you start if he doesn't think you have what it takes to finish. And then he checks you out occasionally in terms of what we call brain maps, what he calls a brain map. Our occupational therapist does the brain maps, and it's quite the process, and I won't get in the weeds or people will go to sleep on us. But a brain map, a functional brain map, shows us every beginning of the school year where is the child's lowest point of deficit. Because that broken area in the brain has to get filled up. And I love it that Carol said to me one day, you know what we're doing? We're filling up the Swiss cheese holes at the bottom of the brain. And I've always loved that mental image because we see it happening. If a child needs heavy work, they want to push everybody on the trike. They don't want to get on the trike and ride it. They're always pushing somebody. And she's taught us how to watch for that and just say, oh, needs heavy work. get a little wagon, fill it with cinder blocks, put him behind it. He will push and push and push until he feels that Swiss cheese hole in the brain. And then he'll hop on the little trike and make it go with his own feet. And it's so exciting to watch. And it doesn't happen like magic. I mean, it doesn't happen tomorrow. We do that for quite a while. Children grow incrementally. It is slow enough that we have teachers come to us and say, is it ever going to happen? Is it ever going to change? And Donna will say, our Nurture Center director will say, yes, just wait, just watch, just trust, just believe, and keep doing what you're doing every day. So we set the interventions, the therapeutic interventions that are sensory motor, are set out of the brain map. We see what the lowest point of deficit is. Doesn't matter if the child is 2 or 3 years old. If the lowest point is brainstem, we'll start there and move up, because that's the neurosequential model, moving up. But the approach has to be relational. It has to be about relating to the child. The child doesn't become self-regulating if they don't have a relationship with the critical adults in their life. And Dr. Perry says, you regulate, relate, then reason. First, a child has to be regulated before they can even relate to you. If they're in a full meltdown in their brainstem, there's no relating to them at all. It takes 30 minutes to 3 hours to bring a child out of their brainstem back into the upper region of their brain. And I've seen it happen at Talitha Kum, and teachers are trained what to do if this happens. And so in all of that period of time, the teacher is giving the child lots of respect and continues very calmly to talk to them or to help co-regulate. Sometimes a child can put their back against your belly and you put your arms around them and say, let's breathe together. Can you hear me? Can you feel my breath? Can you feel my heartbeat? So the adult has to be regulated themselves. There's a real trick, because a lot of us lose it when a child loses it next to us, or if they hit us or kick us, we start getting lost in our own feelings. So our teachers are trained, how are they going to hold themselves together to help that child become co-regulated? First, you co-regulate the child. They feel your heart. They slow their heart rate down. They slow their breathing. But the whole time, the whole aspect of respect is so critical. We don't just say, you know, it's going to help you if you get in this therapeutic swing and you go around and around 20 times. That's going to really help you. Let's do that. No, we sit very, very calmly. And finally, when the child can breathe again and isn't, you know, they're breathing, then we say, would you like to get in the swing? And when they can say yes, then we put them in the therapeutic swing, and it rocks them very gently, and very often they'll go to sleep. They're exhausted. Trauma in their lives is exhausting. They can come in the morning so exhausted they can't do anything but sleep, and we let them sleep. And we never say, what's wrong with you? Because Dr. Perry taught us, and Oprah Winfrey, to say, what happened to you? And it could be what happened to you 3 years ago. It could be what happened to you this morning. But the child doesn't need to answer that question. They don't know why they feel the way they feel. We just allow them to be where they are, and we respect where they are. But regulate first, then you can relate to the child, and only then can you reason with them. And so if you're trying to get a child to do something, we've all had that experience where if we don't attend to their regulation, it's like in any family, a three-year-old gets all upset about something. You can't reason with a three-year-old who's upset. You have to first help them get calm and then relate to them to say, oh, I see you were very upset. They need to know you know how upset they were. You were very upset. You're very sad right now. And then after that relating happens, then you can well, I wonder, what could we do that would solve that problem? That was a problem that gave you a lot of grief. What can we do, I wonder? But all the time, you're moving them up from their lower brain into their prefrontal cortex where they can think, and then they can solve the problem. And it's part of what we do. The high-scope problem solving is critical to what we do. It's 6 steps. People come to take a tour, and they always take a picture of it because I say, hey, I do this with my own grandchildren. It's pure gold. And they get out a camera, take a picture with their phone because it's so critical. And it's all about, can the child solve the problem? All through our society, all through our culture, adults want the problem solved so fast they want to do it themselves. And they come up to 2 children fighting and arguing. I don't know about your boys, but I'll bet they have arguments. I bet they have...
No, never.
Oh, never?
No.
Yeah, never. They pull, they're pulling and tugging on a toy. I want the... You had it first. And by gum, by golly, here comes an adult who's a moral person. And this big person comes up and says something like, why did you take that away from your brother? God says share. And, you know, you're talking to a 3-year-old who has no conception of God, no conception of sharing. It's just not even in there. There's nothing in there for that. It's, I want this toy right this minute. So the first step that we have to get used to is the adult comes and very calmly approaches and then separates these two, and I'll hold the toy. I think I'll hold that car myself. And they get separated. But it's not having a judgment. If children know you are not going to ever judge them, by the time you're able to ask them, what is the problem? They'll both tell you the same thing. One of them will say, I took his car, because you as the adult are not going to judge them. But the most important thing we do is step 2, which is to acknowledge their feelings. And they're both having feelings, not just the one who lost the car. Now the one who took the car is all upset too. And they're both crying or they're both yelling. It's acknowledging that they both have real big feelings about this. We never say, well, that's nothing to argue about. No. You are so upset. And sometimes if we say, oh, you're so sad. No, I'm so mad. Oh, you're so mad. You're so mad. But we get through them knowing that we know how upset they are. If we do that step right, we may not have this to do all the rest of the day. If we don't do step 2 right, if the awareness and acknowledgement of feelings doesn't happen correctly, they may do it. It'll be 20 minutes of calm and then right back at it. They need to know they've been seen and heard and that it's okay that they have big feelings. If it's not okay to have those big feelings, what are they going to do with them? They're going to shut them up and shut them down to the point that if you barely touch them, they go off. No, they need to know it's okay to have big feelings. So we go through the steps, and I don't have them in front of me. And Talitha Coombe teachers will kill me if step 2 is not acknowledging feelings. I think it is. But we go through all of them, and the whole point is to help children solve their own problem. We don't solve it for them. We do give support if they're not being able to think of something. My grandchildren one day were arguing over a piece of what do you call that pop stuff that comes in your packaging.
Right. Yeah.
It pops and they love stomping on it. And one of them had a really tiny piece and the other one had none. And they were arguing over this and they couldn't figure out how would we solve this problem. I said, you know, I wonder if Grandma has more of that somewhere in the house. And they said, oh, does Grandma have more of this? And I went and got a box. We had a box full of it. But they wouldn't have known to say, I wonder if Grandma has more of this. And so we give support if they can't think of something, but almost always they will come up with a solution we wouldn't have thought of, and it's a good solution for them. And then we say, oh, all right, let's do that. You've solved the problem. And then they go very happily off. And very often then the car that was the problem, neither of them wants it anymore. They just drop it in the floor and move on. But now they're happy, and they're glad they solved the problem. And they get to feel the self-esteem of being smart enough to solve that problem. That's a beautiful thing to watch, yeah, or to do.
My memory of that process, and you described it really well, but you know, the first thing that you do as the parent or the caretaker is you come in and just ensure that there is no harmful action. So like you talked about, separating the kids. Okay, so obviously that's you're sort of triaging the conflict situation. And the second, my memory of the second, is that you describe what you see to them. You're not categorizing an emotion. You're just saying, in the effort of helping them tease out what they feel, you're saying, oh, you look so sad. I see big tears. I see a sad face. And then walk them toward the labeling of that emotion. So all, you know, all of that, again, you're stopping the harm. You're letting them know that you see the feeling. And really the feeling is, it just is the feeling. The feeling is not bad. It is not wrong. It just is. And then you allow them to present possible solutions instead of, which my gut is always thinking that I am Solomon in his wisdom and splendor, that I'm going to come up with a magical solution. And that may be fine in the moment, even if I do. I often, my solution is instantly rejected by everybody. But allowing them to be the solution creators.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately, as parents, as caretakers, as teachers, obviously our goal is to do whatever it is that we do for the period that we have these kids so that when they are no longer in our care, they are the best version of themselves that they can be. And if they are always relying on dad, coach, teacher, mom, right, grandma, to come up with the solution as opposed to it being placed in their court, then we've done them a disservice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And who at their public school is going to have time?
Right.
To do, because it takes time. Those six steps can take us quite a long time. We have videos of teachers doing it, and it can take a long time. And it's taking just two children. The reason our ratio is two teachers to six is because this, or a meltdown where a child has lost their mind, it just takes time. So, yes, they're much better off if they have figured out how they can solve a problem. And we did have a mother one time call, and she said, what are they doing? She had three children with us at that time, and they all knew problem solving. And she said, what are they doing? When they're at home, I heard them say, how did you feel when I took your cow? And she said, what are they doing? And we said, well, it's the problem solving steps. And if you want to learn more about that, we would love to teach you. But they were doing it at home, which told us, yes, this can not just happen at Talitha Kum. This really is going to carry over, and it can be there for them.
There are so many, you know, there are so many layers to the Talitha Kum onion that I've learned about over the years. Just hearing you talk about HiSCOPE and the curriculum and neurosequential modeling, you know, obviously to get down into the weeds of sensory, motor sensory development and all of that, you know, there are so many things that you do at Talitha Kum to help build up the ability to self-regulate for kids. But in some ways, I think that if you were to strip all of that out and just have a place where you have the time to spend 2 hours with a child that is dysregulated, to sit there for 30 minutes or an hour or 2 hours with them, just to do step one of getting them back regulated and getting them out of the lower brainstem, and then to spend another 30 minutes with a child to relate to them and do this conflict resolution process, or just let them know that they're loved. And then to work towards being able to reason. If you just were able to do that alone, I think that a place like Talitha Kum would be worth its weight in gold. But that's just a part of what even the Nurture Center does, which is a part, just one part, of what I like to think of as the three-legged stool that you do between family support, mentoring, and the Nurture Center. Mm-hmm. So that's absolutely incredible to me, just that process. And like you said, the ratios of having so few kids per teacher and the benefits that come from that.
And I will tell you, because people ask about this sort of thing, they tend to want to know, are they kindergarten ready, meaning what do they know? How much academic rigor are we adding to our curriculum? HiSCOPE does have quite a lot of academic input for children, but we are not too concerned about what they know. We're concerned whether they're ready to learn, because you could teach a child anything. If they're of any normal intelligence, you can teach them anything if they can self-regulate and be in their prefrontal cortex. So while academics are important eventually, we don't worry too much about them as they leave us to go to pre-K, because we've seen them leave us many times going off to pre-K in public school or kindergarten, and they're ready, so they learn. They're not behind. They're able to learn. We're not as concerned about academic rigor for a four-year-old.
I feel like the gift that Talitha Kum gives is that it presents children to the place that is going to teach them all of the things that they need in a manner where they can then learn those things. As opposed to, I remember you telling a story one time to drive home the effect of living in your lower back portion of your brain. And I've heard you use examples of that if we were sitting here and a tiger were to come in the room, or immediately following a significant car wreck, for example, that in that moment, you and I would not be in a place where we would even be able to learn someone's address. I not long ago, I was going to my in-laws, and we were following behind a young high school girl, and the sun was right in our eyes, and it was a bendy road, and she ran into one of those serious brick mailboxes, mm-hmm. and deployed the airbags, totaled the vehicle, and she was okay because she was going at a pretty low speed, let's say 25, but she came out, and we came up right on her. And I remember after the fact thinking about the state that she was in, that we could barely even talk to her. She was so frantic, and she was hysterical, and all she was saying was, "My parents are going to kill me," which they weren't. They were whenever she called them, they were so happy that she was okay. Right? Any parent, that's going to be their response. But in that moment of where she was in her brain had slid down to this is a survival moment. Mm. And so you are not in or even close to your prefrontal cortex. And that it is incredible to think of spending your childhood where that lower portion of your brain is activated so often. So to help create a process to slowly allow these kids to access the amazing, most, from what I understand, the most incredible thing that scientists know exists in the universe, which is our brains.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, the gift of a brain is the gift of life.
Do you have longitudinal data on your kids?
We do, and it's interesting. Because we have 30 at a time and not hundreds, people would say, well, statistically, you don't really, and you don't have a control group. So we're going off 15 years now of high scope studies, but we keep our records on each child through HiSCOPE's Core Advantage, which is a child observation record. But teachers do this every week, sometimes every day. They're recording what's happening with a child across 8 domains, which include a social emotional component, but some of it is math, science, social studies, and it goes all the way down to the infant classroom. We start in infancy with this curriculum. So we keep the data on that, and there are national benchmarks, and we always say in a grant proposal that our goal is to meet or exceed national benchmarks for something like 85-88% of the children. Sometimes we get 100% of them. If we don't have a child in a class who is developmentally delayed, we can do 100% meet or exceed national benchmarks. But we also keep growth records. So how much did that child grow in period 1 to period 2, which is maybe 3 months? How much did they grow in various areas? But the real test of everything, probably for a lot of folks, is are they graduating from high school? And they are. And our data at least suggests to us that compared to a national group of folks who come out of deep poverty, they are about 20-something percent more apt to graduate or are graduating at a rate that's about 20% higher. And then we're very excited because of all those who have graduated from high school, about 85% have gone on to higher education, whether they went to TSTC or a college or MCC. They're beginning to get the education they're going to need to do well in the world. And that's why I mentioned my mentee graduating from Stephen F. Austin. She now has her first professional job at Methodist Children's Home. Her degree was in child and family studies, and she loves children. She wants to be a counselor. So watching her, even just our relating all those years from the time she was in the first grade is when I began to mentor her until she was in college and all through college, was such a joyous experience. And now that we're podcasting, I will say, we don't have enough of you out there who could, there are many of you out there who could be mentors and take that ride of your life with a child. And it's not that they don't have parents. You work with the parents. I worked with her mom on every front we had, and we were joined together to see things happen, which was a great joy to be with her on that journey. But there are so many people who could mentor a child, and maybe just don't think about it. Or maybe they've thought about it and thought, that would be too hard, or that would be, well, it's not the easiest thing you've ever done, but it's honestly less effort than raising your own children. And some have done this instead of fostering, though our community needs many more foster parents too.
So what does mentoring look like?
It's different. The Talitha Kum way says it's different for everybody. We have a mentor who spent most of his years with his mentee traveling the world, not with the mentee, but sending postcards to his mentee, letting him know where he was on the globe, and he gave him a globe, and he'd point out where he was. But I saw my mentee probably when she was young, once a week. But if I went out of town on vacation, I would let her know when I would be back. They have a tendency to believe they're never going to see you again if you go away. And we worked on that. And when she moved and went to a different elementary school, she was shocked to find me there the first week of school. She thought I was gone forever. But for different people, it's different things. Some people take them into their home for visits. Some people never do that. It is up to the mentor to figure out what's best for the child, what's best for my family. We also have whole families who mentor, and that's delightful to see. Sometimes the mentee is the same age as the children at home, or they pick a mentee who's the right age for their children. We've had teenagers in homes be mentor to a child with the whole family. So it can look various ways, but it's always to help navigate public school, for one thing, and to help mom or dad navigate public school, because many of them became disaffected in their own childhood, their own high school years. Some of them dropped out. Some of them felt really badly about themselves in high school or felt badly treated. And so we work with them to get them engaged back into school. We never try to take their place. The idea is, can we come, as you said, come alongside and do things with you? And parents respond very well to that. They would like to be a part of their child's life in all those ways. So mentoring, just, we say, take them along for the ride of your life. They might never have been in a grocery store. They might never have been to a bank. They don't know why that ATM is giving you money. There are just things they haven't experienced. And then we say, but listen very carefully, because they may whisper something one time and they would never dare to say it again if you don't react. Or if you react negatively, it may be gone forever. And my mentee said to me one day in the third grade, I think I might like basketball. She barely whispered it. And I thought, okay, third grade, you can go to Upward at Columbus Avenue Baptist Church. Here we come. And we did. And then I took her mom to Lady Bears games. And truthfully, she did love basketball. She graduated as the leading point guard at her high school. But she could leap really high, and the track coach saw her leap really high. Ooh, triple jump. Ooh, triple jump. It's hard to find those people. And her mother said, oh, yes, you're going to do this. And she did, and that was her college scholarship, triple jump specialist on the team. And all those experiences, they just happen because somebody's there listening in the moment. And that's the joy of having a mentor.
You know, you talk about families and helping the phrase rise up, not just kids rise up, but families rise up. So I'm just curious, if are there any stories that stick out to you of families that have overcome tremendous adversity by virtue of Talitha Kum staff, volunteers coming alongside them?
Well, my own mentee's mom was very, she had dropped out of high school, had her first baby, I think she was 16, and she came to parent meeting every week, and it was 7 years of weekly parent meetings before she whispered to me one night, "Do you think I could get my GED?" And that's because she needed to feel secure enough to say it out loud. And we don't go to a parent and say, "Now, if you just get your GED, you do so much better." I mean, we don't do this. It's useless. So she finally said it to me, and I said, "Oh, yes, you can, and we'll help you." And we did. And she did get her GED, and then she said, "Do you think I could get my CNA?" And I said, "Well, you have to quit your job for 2 weeks and go to go out to MCC." And yes, you can, and she did. And then later, she had the confidence in herself to go back to school again and get her Med Aid from MCC, and now she has the first job of her life at the VA, where she has benefits and a regular job that really does give her 40 hours a week or more. And it's astounding what the changes have been across my mentee's lifetime to see her mother come into her own that way and to have that kind of confidence. But it does, it's slow. It looks like it may not happen quite a lot of the time. And then when it does, it's just terribly exciting.
So I hear a lot of people, I'm going to go a little higher level, just real quick, kind of systemic. I hear a lot of people say that our education system is broken. Do you think that that's right?
I think it is broken for trauma-affected children. I think it's working beautifully for so many children, but there's some statistical evidence that between 10 and 15% in a high poverty area, between 10 and 15% in every class could be trauma-affected children whose behaviors are disruptive, and they're disruptive to everyone. And I had a Waco ISD teacher, a kindergarten teacher, tell me that, and she had worked for us, she knew what she was talking about. I said, "How many of your students do you think are trauma affected?" I believe she had 20 in the class, and she had identified 8 of 20 who were trauma affected, which means they were either very shut down and they weren't learning, or they were going off like popcorn all day. And when one trauma-affected child goes off, you can imagine that the others get upset, and because it sets their stress response system off. So if you have 8 going off like popcorn, how does a teacher handle that classroom? And it's devastating to the teachers, too. It's harmful to everyone. She has been taught to teach to the prefrontal cortex. They'll give you classes in brain development, in classroom management, but they're teaching you how to teach to a child who's available. What if they're not available? And then the poor teacher is over here being judged. If those children can't take a STAR test and do very well, what if they're not learning? What does that look like for her statistics? And she may be a great teacher doing all she possibly can. So, yeah, the brokenness partly is not having the resources. I mean, think how much money schools have taken away from them. If you don't have the resources and you have to have this many children in a class and you know that some of them are trauma affected, what do you do? Where are the resources that a school has to help those children differently? They're not special ed. They're general population is what they're called, but they're trauma affected and their behaviors are off the charts in a way that teachers aren't prepared to handle.
Well, we talked about the amount of time that it might take to get a child that's in a dysregulated state back to being regulated. And, you know, what comes to my mind is when we are not in our house, if one of my boys is throwing a fit, doing whatever that's, you know, or they themselves are becoming dysregulated, if I'm at home, I have a way greater ability, my wife and I, to dedicate the time that it takes to work through that process of regulate, relate, and then reason. But if we are in the middle of the grocery store, you need that conduct to stop. Mm-hmm. And I feel exactly like you're saying, in a classroom of 20, you do not have time. I my heart breaks for the task that's given to our teachers to say, okay, I need you to teach this, 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 and this. And then also you may have 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever the knock-on effect of having one outburst happens. And somehow you need to try to deal with that. And then don't forget about continuing to teach this, 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 and this. I mean, I almost, you know, but I don't know what the fix is. And so I don't know if in the educational system, just the dedication of individuals to, especially I think elementary, where that is most likely, I mean, we know, and I totally agree with you, the best place to fix that is starting at birth. But as it relates to what the educational system has, it's the earlier the better. And so you have individuals in schools, especially elementary schools, that you can perhaps refer a kid to, that to help get them back regulated. Now, I think to me the challenge of that is what I hear you talk about. When your teachers are helping a child go from dysregulated to regulated, they have often been with that same kid for 2 years. And so they have built that relationship and that trust and that knowledge of safety. And so while I think that it would be fantastic and better than what it currently is to have individuals who that is their job, is to try to help kids self-regulate. But I don't know how you can do that without building a relationship.
Well, no, you do have to have the relationship. There are schools and charter schools or private schools around the country that are being studied that are trying to do trauma-informed practice all day, every day, and they're making a dent in it, and there are ways to do this, but a large public school system is going to change incrementally just the way little children change incrementally. It's going to be a slow process. And so our schools are studying it, looking at it, working with it the best they can. I have no doubt of that. In the meantime, we're losing children. They get on the school-to-prison pipeline by misbehaving, and they do not respond to rewards and punishment. Incentives work for some children. They work for migrant children. They love seeing themselves up there on the chart, on the wall, in green instead of red, and they like that stuff. Children from trauma are actually demotivated by incentives. They work very short term. So we've had parents say to us, well, you tell me not to hit my child. Well, what am I supposed to? And our nurture center director has said to a parent, I've heard her say, I'm not saying you cannot spank your child. Spanking in some situations is fine if you aren't angry when you do it. Yeah. And if And if you stay as calm as you can, but it's not going to change the child. It's very short term. So punishment is detrimental to a trauma-affected child. Rewards don't work. They might work in the very shortest segment of time, the next 2 minutes. But do you have that to do again in an hour? Is the child any different tomorrow? Rewards and punishment don't work for them. And so here you've got 10 to 15% of your kids who aren't responding to what classroom teachers have been told is going to work. And it does work for, here it is, 80%, 85%, whatever the number is. It's working for them. What do we do with the children where it doesn't work? How do we help them? And that is a monumental issue in America.
So, okay, assuming that we're working toward a goal of helping to equip kids, you know, in our education system so that they are mentally healthy, they're physically healthy, they have knowledge and skills by the time that their formal education is complete, ready to bring their talents to bear in the workforce, be productive members of society, all of that. So if you, with that backdrop as a goal, if you could wave a wand and fix one discrete part of our society to try to achieve that, what would you fix?
Well, it would be waving deep poverty. It truly is our enemy. Everyone is suffering because of poverty, not just the people who live it. If you send your child to public school who is affected by children in deep poverty because of their trauma and their behavior, you are affected. Your child is affected. We're all affected by deep poverty, whether we know it or not, whether we avoid seeing it or not. We are truly all affected by it. So if I could wave the magic wand, our whole community would be helping families rise up, not just in Talitha Kuhn's little corner of the world. We would have a whole community surrounding poverty in a way that is transformative for those families, that gives them the honor and the respect of knowing they are doing the very best they can, but they need our help. And so a trauma-affected adult who goes in to get a job, what if they're the ones in full fight or flight? Well, one of two things. I'm going to look down at the table in front of me and not give you eye contact because I'm terrified, and you're going to think, well, how can I hire that person? She didn't even look at me. What happens if a young man comes in and he looks right at you as if, I will kill you. If you get in my way, I will hurt you. And you say, well, I'm not about to hire that person. Some of them are, it's the bluster of self-protection. But if they're never given a chance to show what they can do because they have a look, or because they have a certain tattoo, or it's in a certain place on their body. I mean, if they don't get the chance to even try, where do we go from there? And they're the parents of children, and they're feeling the worst about themselves at a point in time when their children need them to have confidence and self-esteem. Our whole community coming around those families is about what it's going to take. And it's beginning to happen. There are signs of hope. There are groups coming together to function. Prosper Waco has groups where we're getting together to raise up either children or families in healthcare, in jobs. It's happening slowly, but that would be my magic wand, is eradicating deep poverty.
So what are Talitha Kuhn's biggest sort of tangible practical needs?
Well, 74% of our money comes from people. Just people who believe or want to believe, even if they're not sure, they want to believe this is going to work for these kids, and it's about the kids. So 74% of that money comes from just community members. Some give monthly, some give annually, some give a lot, some give a little. It doesn't matter. It all comes together to support us. So it's always about, I'm sorry, it's always about money, but there's also things that people do. We have volunteers who come and volunteer in classrooms. They're not running the show. They're kind of behind the scenes just doing what's needed. We have volunteer groups who come on Saturdays, 10 to noon. There are folks who bring us their hand-me-down, high-quality clothing, toys, books, even furniture, household items. It's amazing how you feel a little differently about yourself when you get a new lamp that works, and that when you turn it on, the light comes on, and it sheds a different kind of light in your home. It's hard to calculate why those things make such a difference, but when people say, can I bring you my hand-me-down whatever, if it's in good shape and it works, we say, bring it on. One of our parents are really going to want that. And that's everything sometimes. So any way a person wants to help usually works.
What would you say is the best way to learn more about Talitha Kum?
Most people tell me that even though they'd heard me speak, or even though they had read our website, being on site for a tour changed them permanently. And they were our ambassadors then, because they really understood it. There's something about a tour at Talitha Kum that gives you a different sense of things. So I invite people to come for tours. And I tell them, I don't care if I'm giving a tour for one person or 40. We've had 40 in the room for Leadership Waco sometimes. But I'll do it one at a time, two at a time. Sometimes they come as friends, husband, wife, whole family, or a Sunday school class, or a civic group. They come and they learn and they do become ambassadors. And it's not for Talitha Kum so much as for trauma-affected children. They become ambassadors for the least of these who cannot speak for themselves.
Well, I appreciate you taking time to sit down and talk about Talitha Kum and the children and families of Talitha Kum.
Thank you. You asked some great questions.